G'day, folks, and welcome. I'm Chris Faber.
And I'm TJ Steadman.
And you're listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast coming to you from sunny Western Australia. G'day, folks, and welcome back to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, the show that tackles your questions about the biblical giants. Actually, I think, Tim, it might be podcasting day or podcasting week or something. Anyway, I could be wrong about that, but I'm 80% confident. Last week, we took a fascinating foray into the meaning behind the birds that Noah sent out from the ark. We also explored the concept of gender for angels.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. And we had a great time doing the show at your place rather than the usual remote hookup. It was a lot of fun. Sorry the audio wasn't perfect, listeners, but we were certainly not in a studio environment. We were in a beer and pizza environment. But yeah, that was some really fascinating stuff. I hope everyone got a lot out of that exploration of the raven and the dove. I think it was really encouraging to find meaning in that text rather than just copycat storytelling from elsewhere in the ancient Near East or falling back on source criticism to explain the difficulties.
Yeah, it was a great episode and great to see you in the flesh, as it were. And I have to admit, I have heard a lot of strange stuff about the story of the flood, but I never heard anything about Noah using the birds as a kind of prayer sent up to God.
Yeah, well, it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. And you can see how it works in the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So what have we got this week?
Well, we covered a big chunk of the text last time, going from verse 6 through to verse 12. But this time, we're going to slow it down a little. We'll be in Genesis 8. Verses 13 to 14. Let's read the text. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw that the surface of the ground was dry. By the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry.
Well, as usual, it's going to be interesting to see what you get out of this text, Tim.
Well, there certainly is a lot going on, but I guess the first thing to say is that we've already done the heavy lifting. We looked at these dates. We talked about manuscript issues. We talked about timeline, chronology, the reason why things are laid out the way they are in this poetic structure. We've talked before about source criticism and the reason why that doesn't work in this text because of its ignorance of the genre. So if you've missed that discussion, all you need to do is go back over these episodes that we've been doing since the beginning of this season of the podcast. Having said that, for those who came in late, I guess it wouldn't hurt to do a quick recap of the pertinent points.
Yes, indeed, that might be a good idea.
Yeah, so let's start with the chronological data. We've got the first day of the first month of the 601st year. That's Noah's birthday. That's not New Year's. And that's actually made clear in this passage we're reading today because we get told that the land is dried up twice. That doesn't mean it happens twice. One verse gives us a calendar date. The other tells us that same day is Noah's birthday. Let's read it again. Genesis 8:13. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. And skipping down to verse 14, by the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. Okay, so verse 13 gives us Noah's birthday. Verse 14 gives us the calendar date. And the repetition of the same idea in both verses connects those two occasions to the same day. But the common argument here is that it gets mentioned twice with different dates. And if so, then this must be the composition of two separate sources. You're going to hear a lot of that from critical scholars. There's no attempt at harmony there because they're approaching the text with that hermeneutic. But as we know with scripture, if you want to find something, you'll find it. That doesn't make it right.
Yeah, you can make the Bible say anything you want if you're desperate enough.
Exactly. The main reason we know that's not the case, aside from the obvious stuff I just pointed out, is the genre issue, which I've made much of in recent episodes of the podcast. We saw how the repetition of particular elements of the narrative is done to work within the poetic structure of the text. The poem mentions the onset of the rain more than once in chapter 7, so why not parallel that with the drying up of the land? These are just easy, logical steps to understanding the text, and they don't require dissection of the narrative. You'll notice that the critical scholars don't do that when they read things like the Epic of Gilgamesh. Remember last week when I read that passage from the flood narrative, and there was actually heaps of repetition in that, but nobody's pulling that apart and saying, well, there must have been a whole bunch of different authors stitching separate texts together. And they're not doing that because nobody's got a dog in the fight. They're not trying to dismantle biblical theology, so there's no need to destroy the text.
So the critics say that repetition in the Bible is a problem, but in any other ancient text, there's no problem. Talk about double standards.
Yeah, the other issue with this text that's already been mentioned is that problematic date of the 27th. And as I mentioned before, you don't find any dates in the biblical story that are not significant elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible. which should be our first major clue that we might have a problem here, since we know that the time of the flood covers the period between Noah's 600th and his 601st birthdays. Then we should be looking for a period of time of precisely one calendar year. We're not concerned with how many days are in the year, as long as we know it was a whole year. And we already had this whole narrative kicking off on the 17th day of the second month, so that's where it's supposed to finish. That means the 27th day of the second month is a problem. That's 10 days too late.
Yeah, because that would mean that Noah's birthday came 10 days later on the same calendar from one year to the next. Imagine everybody turns up for a birthday party at your place and you're like, hey, what are you doing here? My birthday is not for another 10 days.
Yeah, awkward. Now, I mentioned previously that we have evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls that early copies of Genesis may have given a date of the 17th there instead of the 27th. What we actually have isn't a copy of Genesis, but it is a portion of a commentary on Genesis, known as the Genesis Pesha. The reference is 4Q252. I've got a quote here from the translation of that. As I say, it's a commentary, and that takes the form of the original text of Genesis interspersed with additional information designed to help explain the text. The important thing to remember is that while the author is happy to insert additional detail, he doesn't alter the original text. And in the original, according to the source material used in this commentary, that date of drying up the land is the 17th, is the quote. And at the end of the 31 days from Noah having sent out the dove, which did not return to him again, the waters dried up from upon the earth, and Noah removed the cover of the ark and looked, and behold, they had dried up on the fourth day, on the first day of the first month in the year 601 of Noah's life. On the 17th day of the second month, the land dried up on the first day of the week. And as far as those extra details are concerned, and I'm talking about the added stuff like telling us what day of the week it was and all that, that's in there to support the view of the community at Qumran that their calendar maintained the correct dates for proper religious observance, and it does no violence to the text of Genesis to hold that view. But as we've said before, that's not the original function of the text in the Bible. Genesis is not providing a calendar. Unfortunately, because we don't actually have a copy of Genesis that preserves the 17th as read by the author of the Genesis Pesha, that means that date isn't going to appear in our modern Bibles, whether it belongs there or not.
And why is that?
Well, we're going to have to find an original manuscript of Genesis that has that date in it in order to be able to put that into official biblical translations. But that's one of those instances where a good study Bible should be able to help you out there. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of any that will provide that information. That leaves one last objection to the idea that these two verses, 13 and 14, in Genesis 8, are referring to the same day. You'll hear people say they can't be the same day because one says the water dried up, but the other says completely dry. And they'll argue that there's a difference. Like, one means no water but probably still muddy, and the other means bone dry, like no moisture at all. That is entirely fabricated. You literally cannot make that claim on the basis of the text. Where it comes from is actually Berossus. So he was a Greek historian who wrote about the Babylonian flood traditions. And he talks about there being mud on the feet of the dove that returns to the boat. That seems to have been read back into interpretations of Genesis at some point and just taken as gospel, but it ain't. Having said that, there is a significant difference between the terms in our reading.
Really? So what kind of difference are we talking about here?
Not the kind of difference that fans of Berossus are looking for, but actually something far more interesting and consistent with our reading of the flood narrative as a whole. While it's true that only one of these terms is directly synonymous with the idea of being dry, as in devoid of water, the other is definitely not anything to do with some sort of a degree of dryness or moisture. We'll start with the obvious. When we read verse 14, we see that the land was completely dry, and that's literally what it means. It's a fitting end to the flood narrative, which is, after all, a story about a guy in a boat and lots of water. The only right way to end the flood story is the finality of the dry land. And we talked last week about the flight of the raven and how the bird kept flying until the water had dried up. That's the same terminology, which just goes to strengthen that connection between the release of the bird and the goal of drying the land.
Okay, right, so that's quite significant.
Yeah, but it's the first mention of dryness that really gets our attention here. Verse 13 says, in the NIV, that the water had dried up from the earth. And you just know I'm about to tear this apart.
No, surely not, Tim. That doesn't sound like you at all. Actually, it does, doesn't it?
You know me well. Let's begin with the water. Actually, that's supposed to say waters. That's plural. Nothing we haven't seen before, though. When we see the use of hamayim, we should be thinking straight away about spirits. That's what we've seen in Genesis from the beginning. The waters represent the domains of spiritual entities, both above and below, cosmologically speaking. And that's the good guys and the bad. The good guys from the waters above and the baddies from the other place. So we're back into the language of opposing sides in a conflict that's been going on since back in the days of Cain. So this language of the waters is inclusive of the giants, the fallen angels, the angels of God, the whole lot, with the exception that those seven destroying angels, Hamayim Hamapul, had already withdrawn. And I'm not going to mention the demons because this isn't First Enoch, so those guys aren't in the mix here, and we don't have any human combatants involved because the Nephilim had already destroyed them all with the exception of Noah's family. So all those forces that have been at war throughout the flood story are the subject here, but what's happened? Why are we being told they dried up?
Yes, indeed. What does that mean?
What it means is that we're going to have to get under the skin of that terminology. In Hebrew, what we have here is charbu, a term that we find some 40 times in the Hebrew Bible, and it enjoys a fairly uniform distribution across the scriptures. So that's a lot of usage in a variety of literary and historic contexts. And consistently, what we see in the use of this term is the concept of ruin, desolation, and destruction. The way that gets described is through the idea of dryness. Because if water means life and growth and potential, then the absence of water is death, destruction, and waste. So drying up is the language of desolation and ruin. So let's take a moment to zoom out a bit and read the passage again. In light of this information, I'm going to paraphrase. So verse 13 and 14, according to me. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the waters had been laid waste on the earth. Noah then turned aside the covering of the ark and saw that the appearance of the ground was desolate. By the 27th day of the second month, the land was completely dry.
Yeah, that reading really brings out a bit more of that interpretation, which we don't really see normally in English translations.
Yeah, so I've tried to bring out the less overt aspects of the passage there, and hopefully that works for you without undermining the plain reading. This is a picture of ruinous wasteland, not a pretty green hillside with animals frolicking and not a cloud in the sky. This is the aftermath of a war that consumed every inhabitant of the land, or the world from the perspective of the author, and it's not just a clean sweep. We're talking mass destruction, wrecks and ruins everywhere, collapsed buildings, flood damage as far as the eye can see. It's a mess. And that kind of utter devastation, think of every newsreel from the Middle East you've ever seen. That's what we're talking about. But we've got one more thing to uncover here in this text. I'm talking, of course, about the covering of the ark. Did you see that pun there? How good was that? Now, this is very cool. We've talked before about sacred space and how the ark is a kind of floating sanctuary. We had the dimensions of the ark and the threefold division of it, all reminiscent of Eden and of the tabernacle and the temple. We had the language of atonement and the concept of dedication and consecration, and what we have here in this passage is one of the strongest ties to this idea in the whole narrative. When Noah removes the covering of the ark, he's doing what was done countless times as the Israelites prepared to worship God at the tabernacle. It's the same language you'll see when the priest opens the curtain to enter the tent of meeting. And that's going to sound weird because we know how the ark was built. We know what was involved in its construction. And as far as we know, the ark didn't have curtains.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds a bit weird. So what's going on there?
I think it's intentionally telling us this to get a message across. You see that language as an observant Jew, you're going to know that this is connecting the ark with the tabernacle, conceptually. There's a lot more than that going on. This isn't just a reminder of sacred space and the continuity of worship. It goes much deeper. That word for covering there, that's associated with the tabernacle everywhere you find it, except here. Obviously, that's because you're supposed to read this and think of the tabernacle. But there's also a certain association with a particular material used in the construction of the tabernacle coverings. Let me show you. What I'm about to read is a selection of passages. There are 12 that feature the term found in Genesis 8:13. 11 if you don't count that one, and 3 of the 11 don't refer to this specific covering material, so these 8 verses are what we have left. Exodus 26:14. Make for the tent a covering of ram skins dyed red, and over that a covering of the other durable leather. Exodus 36:19. Then they made for the tent a covering of ram skins dyed red, and over that a covering of the other durable leather. Exodus 39:34, the covering of ram skins dyed red, and the covering of another durable leather, and the shielding curtain. Numbers 4:8, they are to spread a scarlet cloth over them, cover that with the durable leather, and put the poles in place. Numbers 4:10, then they are to wrap it and all its accessories in a covering of the durable leather, and put it on a carrying frame. Numbers 4:11, over the gold altar they are to spread a blue cloth and cover that with the durable leather and put the poles in place. Numbers 4:12, they are to take all the articles used for ministering in the sanctuary, wrap them in a blue cloth, cover that with the durable leather and put them on a carrying frame. Numbers 4:25, they are to carry the curtains of the tabernacle, that is the tent of meeting, its covering and its outer covering of durable leather, the curtains for the entrance to the tent of meeting. Okay, so you probably noticed the repetition of this phrase, the covering of durable leather. Since this comes up in 8 of the 12 situations where we get this language of covering, like what we saw in connection with Noah's Ark, we should probably be paying attention to that.
But what is this covering of durable leather? Is it like cowhide or something?
There have been theories, many and varied. Suggestions have traditionally included the following: hides of sheep, dolphins, antelope, sea cows, badgers, seals, porpoises, goats, manatees, or fine or beaded leatherwork. I've also seen suggestions that it's not a type of skin, but a name for something used to colour the skins. So this phrase, techashim verot, is hard to pin down in particular because it isn't Hebrew. This is another one of those situations where you need some Semitic cognate language skills to help you out, because it turns up in a form very close to this in Arabic. We've got a fair idea of what it means in Arabic.
Okay, so what is it?
Bet you weren't thinking I'd go with the dolphins here, but I think that's where we're going to land.
Okay, you mean like porpoises?
Yeah, and that definition might stretch to something like a dugong, manatee, or sea cow. It turns out these used to be really common in the Red Sea, and they have a tough hide that's waterproof and really hard wearing. Pretty handy for covering your precious stuff that you've got to drag through the desert, rain, hail, or shine.
Okay, but so what? I don't see how this has anything to do with Noah's Ark.
Did you say sea cow?
No, I said I don't see how.
Oh, you don't see how the sea cow has anything to do with it. Okay, so think about this. In the tabernacle, the use of these dolphin hides is meant to provide a representation of the cosmic waters above the heavens. It's kind of like a physical representation of the firmament. And since this language of sea cow hide is so frequently associated with the idea of the covering of the tabernacle, when the covering of Noah's Ark gets mentioned, it's just a mental reflex to connect those thoughts. The covering of the Ark was also durable and waterproof. And since the Ark, like the tabernacle, gets described in a way that makes it a microcosm of creation, that representation of the expanse between the heavens and the earth is very fitting. But there's another thought that I want to tie in here.
But wait, there's more. Call in the next 15 minutes and we'll throw in a free set of steak knives.
Skinning knives, perhaps. And don't call us. This isn't that kind of show. Anyway, aquatic beasts have been killed and skinned to provide these skins for the covering, and they could be seen as representative of the spiritual powers of the deep, the abyss. These things could represent the watchers, the fallen sons of God, and we're here seeing their corpses stretched out over the ark. So the first allusion to the Mesopotamian Apkallu tradition in the flood story, since it was introduced in Genesis 6, comes after it's all over. God saved his people, and he's won a great victory over both divine and human rebels. And part of signifying that victory is dropping a subtle reference to the skins of the creatures of the sea draped over the outside of the sanctuary in which God preserves the lives of his faithful ones. You know what it also makes me think about? The curtain of the temple that was torn in two from top to bottom when Jesus was crucified. That's beautiful, but I think it also tells us something about how God is dealing with the divine rebels. He strips them of their skins, their embodiment. They've now lost that glorious form they once had. And that's going to be important as we continue through the primeval history and we consider the nature of the continued struggle against the powers of darkness in the world.
Some great insights there as usual, and it's going to be interesting to see how all this connects to stuff that comes out later in the biblical story.
That's right, mate. As I've said so many times, this is the prequel to the scriptures, which sets you up for the main story to cast it in a new light from the perspective of the first audience. It will all get clearer as we continue to read through these early chapters, and the more you engage with the text of the Old Testament, the more you'll see the connections being made here.
That's right. Indeed, indeed. And for now, it's time to wrap up our study. But before we go, we've got some Q&A.
I want to hear your giant questions. If you have a question about stuff you've heard on the show or somewhere else, something you found in your Bible, or just some general feedback you'd like to tell us and the world at large, here's how you do it. Head to the website giantanswers.com. I personally receive all your mail, and I will try to get to all of it. I love hearing from you, especially if I can help you get answers to your giant questions.
Tim, I am assuming another one, asked via the website giantanswers.com. TJ, I must admit I have not read your book yet and have only caught a few episodes of your podcast. I heard your interview on Genesis Mark's Spot and am fascinated with several of the things you said that differ slightly from what Dr. Heiser and others teach. My question at this time is regarding the idea that the Deuteronomy 32 fallen beings are the same as the Genesis 6 fallen beings. I really like this idea. Your logic seems solid, and the idea of a second fall of high-ranking spiritual beings really leaves a lot of questions about the loyalty of any of these beings to God. However, when you look at the language of the abyss in 2 Peter and Jude, and you look at how the demons in Luke 8 feared being sent there, the place seems pretty restrictive. How are they still able to rule the nations from there? It would seem that they can no longer become embodied, yet they influence the affairs of nations, affect the natural world, and manifest themselves somehow through idols. They are certainly not omnipresent, but can they be acting in several places at once? If you have addressed this in your podcast or have any additional thoughts or suggestions for study, I would appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, well, firstly, thanks, Tim, and yeah, that wasn't me, for sending in that question, and I certainly have addressed it in the past in numerous places, and the book will be a great resource for that. We've also got some podcast episodes that have touched on this, because the question comes up quite often. In fact, I was talking about this just now at the end of our study. Here are just a few of those references. Season 2, Episode 6, We Are Groot. Season 2, Episode 14, Not Good to Be Alone. Season 4, Episode 7, The Mouth of the Ground. Season 4, Episode 8, Avenged Sevenfold. Season 4, Episode 11, The Lesser of Two Enochs. Season 4, Episode 13, Mahujael. Season 5, Episode 6, Seth in His Place. Season 5, Episode 9, Mahalalel. Season 5, Episode 14, The Legacy of Enoch. Season 6, Episode 15, The End of All Flesh. Season 6, Episode 19, The Procession of the Destroyers. Season 7, Episode 7, Escape from the Seven Thunders. Season 7, Episode 8, When God Opens a Window. And Season 7, Episode 13, Death and Desolation. And I probably missed a few there.
Phew, I'd say we've got that pretty well covered.
Yep, so that's why I won't be going into any particular detail on that right now. You've got plenty to catch up on in those resources I just mentioned, but there are still a few things to talk about just briefly. Let's have a look at that idea of embodiment through idols and that sort of thing. I've already talked a lot about the nature of embodiment when it comes to these divine beings and the fact that they don't require three-dimensional space necessarily to be present. This is what I was talking about a moment ago with the sea creature hides and that idea of the lack of physical embodiment. What that means is you can't pin them down to a particular location. And this doesn't have to be strictly about fallen angels and that kind of thing, because all the Elohim function the same way. But as Tim alluded to in his question, they don't have the kind of omnipresence that we would normally associate with the Most High God. When God is at work in the world, he isn't limited to a particular time or place. He doesn't have to rush around keeping appointments, like he's got to be at the Vatican at 10:30, and then he's got to be at Jerusalem at 10:45, and then at 11 p.m. he's got to appear in Mexico on somebody's piece of toast. And in that respect, the lesser gods are pretty much the same. Whatever form the work of a divine being takes, the way that we're going to experience that is through localization around a particular phenomenon. And in the ancient world, that is what idols were for. That's the body through which the god works, but that's not a limitation to his presence or action. The reason things work that way in this day and age is because these fallen angels are no longer capable of manifesting their own embodiment in the way that they did prior to the flood. The nature of their imprisonment is a limitation on their ability to use their power in a directly embodied fashion. But because the gods are able to work in many and varied ways in the world without the necessity of physical embodiment, their influence in the world is much more pervasive than simply the kind of influence that might be exerted through a particular temple or place of worship, or a human king for that matter. They participate in and help to shift and shape entire cultures and civilizations, and they might work more directly through powerful figures like religious or political leaders, but they're at work in every facet of culture. And that's why the ultimate weapon in the war against the gods is the church. Because through the church, the Holy Spirit is an agent of cultural change as well, and our job as part of that church is to participate in that change in order to bring about that cultural shift. The battle has always been against culture. That was the boast of the Babylonians, and it's the war we continue to fight day to day in our lives, which is why the New Testament is all about how we should live in view of these things and why in the book of Revelation, the Babylon motif works so well, whether we're talking about Rome or whatever empire rules the world today.
That makes a lot of sense, as usual.
Yeah, and at this point, I want to bring in another question that was sent in by another listener, because I've got a really good question sent in by the website, giantanswers.com, by a lovely young lady whose name is Anne, and she wanted to know if demons could read our thoughts. So you can see how this is kind of related, right? Because we're talking about how the forces of darkness in the world are able to influence our culture and culture leaders. Can the bad guys get in our heads and understand what we're thinking? Do they read our minds?
Yeah, I've wondered about that before, as I'm sure many others have.
Here's the thing about demons and fallen angels. They've been around for a long time. They know how people work. And they're able to observe and remember all kinds of things about you. Remember that they're the ones who keep a record of wrongs against you while Jesus forgives and blots out your sins. They don't need to read your mind when they've been observing how you operate in the world since you were born. They're pretty good at predicting human behavior, but we have no evidence that they can actually read your mind. What they can do, however, is influence your thoughts. Not really sure how that works, but I've definitely seen that it does work. I think this really gets into the realm of the subconscious and subliminal influence. It's become popular terminology these days, but we often hear people talking about intrusive thoughts, and I'm talking about those situations where a thought pops into your head, which is usually destructive, violent, self-harming, or degrading, the kind of thing that's actually out of character for you when you consider the way in which you normally conduct yourself. The reason self-control is one of the fruits of the Spirit is because it's the Holy Spirit's natural defense against these things. Now, I'm not saying that every sinful thought that you have is coming to you from demons or fallen angels. We are plenty capable enough of creating problems for ourselves. But if you're in tune with the Holy Spirit, you will recognize when these things are external attacks coming upon your mind, and it usually comes on the back of some kind of positive experience or some good thing. The next, you know, the most horrible and depraved thoughts come across your mind. Usually something that reminds you of your life before Christ or something that was out of character for you to have done. The good news is that you don't have to remain a victim of these things. You can immediately claim the forgiveness of Christ. And I've been saying this since the very beginning of this podcast, way back in season one. As long as you keep your life in tune with the Spirit of Christ and you maintain your allegiance to Him, then you have the authority of Christ within you because of your proximity and your faithfulness to Him and His faithfulness towards you. Right? And that's what's really driving it there. Christ will protect you. He will vouch for you before the heavenly powers. You are no longer subject to the accusations of the evil one. Knowing that and proclaiming it, if you have to, is going to set you free. But I want to talk quickly about mental health here because that's very important. Not suggesting that there's anything wrong with the mental health of the good people who send us these questions. It's just that I feel a certain responsibility to address these things for the sake of those listening. We don't all have perfect mental health, and in fact, the majority of us don't. I'm going to suggest that most of the time, what we would classify as mental illness has nothing to do with demons and that kind of thing. It's certainly true that they will attack the mind. There are definitely cases where a person's poor mental health is a result of oppression by intelligent forces of evil. And others where existing mental health issues are used and manipulated as a way of getting at someone. I'm not one of those people who suggest that exorcism is the only way to deal with everything from schizophrenia to headaches. And at the same time, I'm not going to say that you can just medicate these things in 100% of cases. And it might not even be an either-or situation. Everybody has a unique situation which requires care and healing of the whole self. That's why living in community with your church is a good thing. That way you're surrounded by people who know you and care about you, who will speak truth into your life and will help you get the appropriate care. You can't really manage that kind of thing on your own. And of course, there's also the issue of not giving the devil a foothold in your mind. Don't subject yourself to things that aren't good for your mental health. Stay away from drugs. Be careful about what you're watching and listening to. And be selective about who you allow to speak into your life. I can't tell you how many times I've said on this program, don't get your theology from smoking weed and watching YouTube. I've seen what it does to people, including more than one of my good friends. So please take that seriously.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. That's very good advice as usual. Well, that's all we've got time for today. And as usual, we'll be back next week with more nuggets of gold from the scriptures and more answers to your giant questions.
You know it. Thanks to Tim and to Anne for those questions today. That was some great stuff to talk about. And don't forget, listeners, you can send in your own giant questions by jumping on the website, giantanswers.com, and using the form on the main page there. Also, keep that discussion going in our Answers to Giant Questions discussion group on Facebook, because certainly I haven't covered everything related to that there. It'd be good to see what everybody has to contribute to that discussion. You can also find us on the socials and contact me that way if you prefer. Anyway, that's all for now. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week. See you then.
Bye-bye.
It's time to wrap up today's episode, but if you want more, don't forget to get yourself a copy of Answers to Giant Questions. We're asking readers to please leave a review of the book on Amazon or Goodreads to help it become more visible in search results. Even if you just give it stars, that'll help, but a full review is certainly really appreciated. Please also leave a review of this podcast wherever you found us so that new listeners can find us here on the show. This podcast comes out every week, but you want to make sure you never miss an episode, so if you haven't already subscribed, do that now and you'll get notified when each new episode drops. We'll catch you next time on the Answers to Giant Questions podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, a production of the Raven Creek Social Club. If you like what you heard today, please take a moment to rate or review the show. Music supplied under copyright by Grave Forsaken, graveforsaken.com. You can get the book Answers to Giant Questions by TJ Stedman on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format. Check out the other podcasts at ravencreeksc.com and go to giantanswers.com for more answers to giant questions. Read the blog and catch us on the socials. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. Send us your giant questions and stay tuned to this podcast to get answers. We'll see you next time. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
What, a dozen weeks till Christmas or something?
Yeah, I know. And yet, I still have to move mountains to find eggnog.
Well, hopefully, it is the noggy season upon us once more.
Well, you know, as you say, it's October.
Yeah, well, you know, Halloween and Christmas decorations seem to be in shops.
Well, that's right. Time. So, you know, the eggnog needs to follow.
Mm.
In fact, follow not even follow, it should be concurrent.
Mm.
If I had my way, it'd be perpetual.
Mm. Not seasonal.
Mm. We'll have a good nog.
Slam down that nog, slam it down fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wedding anniversary was last weekend.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so.
Did you watch the grand final?
Nah, we went to the Royal Show.
Why would you do that? It's filled with people. But the kids like it?
You know. Oh, yeah, they love it. In fact, they went twice.
Wow. Did you pick up a show bag for yourself?
Liz did grab, you know, a few show bags, just, you know, like chocolates and licorice and that sort of thing, which I always enjoy. So that's licorice. All I really wanted. Not a licorice fan?
Oh, definitely not.
Oh, I love it.
I hate it as much as durian, if not more.
Wow.
Yep. Top two hates.
I see. So what about aniseed?
Yeah, that's the same.
You eat the black cats in the party mix?
No, definitely not. No. Okay. Satan, licorice, durian, aniseed.
Right. And black jelly beans.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. I see. No, I don't mind them. I don't like being surprised by them, mind you. Right?
Like, yes.
We're in the cinema and, you know, you put lollies in my hand and they go to my mouth and I'm going to be upset if there's, like, you know, black cats or the black jelly beans kind of snuck in there. Because yes. You know, I sort of needed to be prepared for it, you know?
Indeed.
So, like, I don't mind turning up last to the office lolly bowl and everybody has eaten all the other flavors and just left.
Sure.
The black cats, I will eat them. But, yeah, you don't want to be surprised by something like that.
No.